Let's begin today with a tension, one that many of us are feeling during the coronavirus pandemic, the need to keep as many people as possible safe from the virus and the want to reopen and return to some kind of normal. That tension has started to bubble over in some places around the country, including here in New England, as the shutdowns and stay-at-home orders continue. Over the weekend, some 100 folks turned out at the Bourne Rotary to call for an end to the shutdown, and in New Hampshire, on Saturday, a few hundred people turned up at the State House to protest the Granite State's stay-at-home order. One of that event's organizers is J.R. Hole, a former Republican state representative, and he says it's about saving New Hampshire's economy.
The cure is worse than the disease. We've effectively lost 125,000 jobs in New Hampshire. We see now four hospitals laying off massive staff. So not only did we not see the surge that everybody was worried about, we are now so far away from that that we're in danger of losing our regional hospitals.
And Hole tells us that they'll continue to protest because there are civil liberty tensions at play.
There's an economic side, right, about jobs. There is clearly a constitutional side of this, and I would say the civil liberties falls under there. When people are told that they can't do certain things that the Constitution allows them to do, the right to assemble being one of them, that is of concern.
So let's pick it up there. Are you frustrated with the stay-at-home advisories? Are you concerned about folks not following those advisories and the social distancing guidelines? Can you be feeling both at the same time? And what is the balance between preserving public health and preserving civil liberties? Share your thoughts. What do you think about this? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us now on the line is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She is a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, good to have you back.
Good to be on again.
So, Judge Gertner, your private law practice focused heavily on defending clients against government overreach. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's right.
So this is something you've thought a lot about. And I want to start by asking you, there's a lot of variation on actions taken by governors across the country. What is the power of governors to make these decisions? And what do you make of the pushback of the kind that we just heard, you know, a minute ago?
Governors have the, and all public authorities have public health responsibility. And the question is what the, how far that can go. And what's interesting about and troubling about coronavirus is that it is a disease, obviously, of contagion. It's a disease that you could get from someone you don't know, as opposed to AIDS and other diseases like that. So if my neighbor decides to go out in the street and mingle with someone and then decides to help me by delivering my newspaper, I could conceivably get it. It's a disease of contagion where what happens to me is affected by everyone around me.
And does that in some way sort of constitutionally or legally change the rights and abilities of governors on what they can do, what they can impose on their people?
It certainly does. In other words, there is, on the one hand, public health authority, public health obligations. Then the question is whether or not the restrictions, whether or not the rules match the extent of the public health problem. So, for example, I know that in New Hampshire, people protested motorcycle helmets, having to wear motorcycle helmets. And there the public health issue was, if you crack your head up, you're going to go to the local emergency room, and it'll tax our system. Now, that was a much more attenuated relationship than what you have here, which is your virus can wind up getting to me. So the issue is there authority here? Yes. The question is, do you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
The question is the scope of that authority. I said the question is the scope of that authority.
Yeah, I want to go back for a second because it's interesting because I actually had in my mind as one of the things to ask you about a comparison to helmet laws, which feel apt. You talked about HIV/AIDS a minute ago, and you did say you can't contract that from someone you don't know. You actually could, right, through sharing of needles with somebody maybe you didn't know, or there's concern about blood transfusions. It sounds like part of what you're saying is it's the type of contagion that comes from coronavirus, and that actually those things actually affect public policy and what you can and can't do. Am I understanding you correctly?
That's right. I mean, I think that there are lots of ways in which the government regulates health, vaccine laws, helmet laws, regulates what a drug company can do and the distribution of drugs. This is what was significant about coronavirus, so the scientists told us, is that there can be community transmission here, as opposed to direct, intimate partner transmission. And so if there's community transmission, if it is so easy to catch, then the scope of what the government can do has to match that. It's not enough to say, I should stay in my house. The issue is, my neighbors have to as well.
So doesn't that then, or should it then, I guess I should ask you, put strong demands on the government to roll those things back when the concern about contagion is past? You know, I'm thinking about legitimate concerns about government overreach in times of emergency in the past, maybe the FISA court system after 9/11, for example.
No, I think that's right. I think that your opening was exactly right. There is a danger here. And the danger is that powers that are obtained during a emergency wind up extending beyond the emergency on the one hand, and extending beyond the needs of the emergency. So in some countries, for example, this is extended to the government mining cell phone data in order to trace people's contacts. I was just reading about in Western Australia, rather, the government required that people had tracking devices in their homes if they were contagious. So the question is, how far can the government go? How much can it obtain our personal information? Is it voluntary or involuntary? And does it now go past the needs of the emergency? Those are questions that are legitimate and fair questions to ask.
Judge Gertner, let's take a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We've got Michael on the line. I think you're driving, right? Michael, you're driving in Haverhill?
That's right, yeah. And I just wanted to say, as a reminder to people, your civil liberties won't count for much if you're not healthy. Yeah, they're important, but if you're endangering other people, you infringe on their civil liberties anyway. So taking these precautions to keep yourself safe, to me, is much more important than protesting down in whatever states are doing it.
Thanks for that call, Michael. And to add to that, Judge Gertner, it makes me think, and I'm going to butcher it, the famous quote from Ben Franklin, right, about those who who essentially sacrifice their liberties in order to maintain safety actually get neither. So there is a tension here, the kind that our caller was just talking about.
There is a tension. There's no question about it. But as I said, that means you have to monitor the monitors. But it doesn't necessarily mean they don't have the authority to do this. In fact, I have to say something about this cure is worse than the disease, which is something our president has recited over and over again. The cure here is not to be dead. The cure here is not to be dead, which for a very high percentage of people, the disease here is not to be dead. So the notion of what can we do to prevent deaths, it seems to me is a reasonable question. And given the toxicity, as they say, of this virus, that's something that should be weighed in the balance here rather than my ability to get my nails done.
Let's hear from Governor Baker on that, actually. This is him from yesterday when he was asked about protests against stay-at-home orders. Here's what he said.
This is not like any other virus, and I really hope people recognize and understand why it's so important that people act on these initiatives that we've put in place, why we're grateful that the vast majority of the people in Massachusetts have, and to appreciate that this isn't being done to punish anybody, okay? It's being done to try to keep people safe, and it's being done based on data and information on an unprecedented virus as we gather it and as it comes together.
So, it strikes me that the governor is consistent in those comments, Judge Gertner, with what you just said. You also brought up President Trump, and one of the things that's been interesting with him over the last week is he has given mixed messages. So first, he tweeted about liberating states like Virginia, Minnesota, Michigan that had strong stay-at-home orders. But last night, he criticized the governor of Florida for opening too soon against federal guidelines. In this time where we have these extreme tensions, how important is transparency and consistency in the communication from those who are using, let's say, exceptional powers in order to keep people safe?
Well, let me start with the consistency. Think about it this way. We don't have a cop on our corner because the police trust that we will follow even an invitation not to go outside. In other words, we trust our health authorities enough that we don't need a drone overhead to enforce when I'm going out and walking the dog. If the president is all over the map about what is appropriate and what is not, it then enables my neighbor across the way to say, well, the hell with this, I don't have to follow it. That leads to two problems. One is the problem that then there will be contagion. And the other problem is then there will be pressure for more forceful measures. And that would be very troubling. That would be troubling. Right now, we're following it because we all, at least in this state, believe it's important to do.
Last question for you, Judge Gertner. For those who are deeply anxious, not only about civil liberties, but about the need to prevent any more harm than is necessary to people economically, what are the channels and venues appropriate to them to create tension and pushback so that the government does cede back the ability to participate in the economy, you know, I think you understand what I'm saying. What are the right avenues during a pandemic to put that pressure back on your government appropriately?
Well, let me start with the wrong avenue. The wrong avenue is a non-socially distant demonstration on Boston Common. That's the wrong avenue. That's like purposely circulating HIV or doing something to protest a rule with regard to HIV. That doesn't make any sense. So I think there are letters and calls, these programs like this, letters to the editor, letters to the governor. I think those kinds of issues. And if it happens that the regulations outstrip the period of the safety problems, then you go to court. I mean, there really is a question of, you know, what's the recourse if the government continues this longer than it has to, and there's a recourse to the court. But in the short term, we have to monitor using the tools available to us.
That's WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. It was great to have you on today, Judge Gertner. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So listening into that conversation was Dr. Shira Doron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Doron, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
And if you have a question for Dr. Doron about the importance of these guidelines, what we know about the virus at this point, COVID-19 and how it spreads, call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We want to hear from you. First, Dr. Doron, I'd love to get your thoughts on what you just heard and the concerns raised about the economy, civil liberties, the pain of the shutdowns versus the pain to public health that would come from not being shut down.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard. I don't want to make light of the suffering that everyone is going through due to the economic shutdown. I think it's really important to remember one thing, and that is something that we all get confused about sometimes. Distancing measures were never meant to make it so that I don't get it, or that you don't get it, because that might be inevitable at some point. They were meant so that you and I and everyone else in the state don't get it all at once or too many at once, so that there are still hospital beds, ICU beds, ventilators available to save my life or your life if we do get the disease.
So does that mean that there's really, short of a vaccine, no way to be sure you don't get it? It's just that we want to make sure that if you do, you can have the healthcare treatment that you need?
Exactly. And it's not even about preventing all deaths, because people are going to die from COVID-19. It's about preventing preventable deaths, especially deaths that will occur because of an overwhelmed medical system. And it's not even all COVID-19 death, because this isn't just about COVID-19. If the hospital doesn't have any beds or any ventilators or any ICU capacity, then a person with a heart attack or a stroke can't get treatment either.
So, Dr. Durone, I cover Governor Baker's press conference every day, and from, I don't know, probably close to 10 days now, he's been reporting that the hospital bed capacity in the Commonwealth has hovered at about 50% available, roughly. It comes up and down a little bit. Does that mean that that mission has essentially been accomplished and we are in a situation where we've got the healthcare capacity to keep people from dying unnecessarily due to lack of access to healthcare?
It doesn't really mean that yet. So whereas many hospitals have bed capacity, they may not have, and mine doesn't necessarily have, ICU capacity. And although we've all flexed into our surge plans and opened what we call ICU beds in a lot of other places in the hospital, so we're able to say we have capacity in our surge plan, that doesn't mean that we're not, because we are, taking care of patients, critically ill patients, in areas where we don't normally take care of critically ill patients, using staffing models that are not our usual, using equipment that's really outside of the ordinary. So things are definitely not business as usual here. People are working much longer hours than they should, and our equipment shortages are still a very significant issue, both personal protective equipment and the equipment that we use for critical care.
Dr. Durone, the calls are just flowing in. So let's take a couple. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Jan on the line from Cape Cod. Jan, do you have a question for Dr. Durone?
Hi, yes, thank you. I have noticed from all the different news, print and television, that there hasn't been a good diagram or a picture showing how this can be transmitted, really clearly in really simplistic everyday terms. I go to the grocery store, I touch something, someone touches it, goes to the post office, they talk with somebody, maybe they didn't have a mask or something, or maybe they touch the front of their mask when they put it on and off, and then, you know, just different things, and then they went somewhere else, and then they were talking, but they weren't far enough, and so the air, you know, just different types of things. I don't know. And I think for various reasons that people, I think there's a disconnect, and many public health initiatives usually involve a behavior modification, a behavior sort of what is it, how, and why. And I feel like they keep saying, do social distance, do this because we're telling you. But people, I think, need that educational component, but I think it's been missing.
Great. Let's turn to Dr. Durone and see if you can you paint that simple picture, Dr. Durone?
I wish it was that simple, actually, because, you know, this is actually one of the many struggles that we all face with the fact that it's a new virus and that there's still a lot that's unknown. Now, what we know is that the primary mode of transmission is what we call droplet and contact. So the majority of infections occur from those large droplets. You cough or you sneeze, and a droplet of mucus, for lack of a better word, ends up in somebody else's mucous membranes, usually their eyes, nose, or mouth, and that's how they get the disease. You could also wipe your nose and touch a surface that somebody else comes along and touches. And those are the primary modes of transmission. And we know that based on a number of things, including looking at how many people become infected from any one given person. That's different than airborne transmission organisms like measles and tuberculosis. I'm sure you've seen in the past, over the years, announcements that if you've been to such and such coffee shop, you've been exposed to measles and you should contact your doctor. That's not going to happen with this disease because it doesn't hang out in the air. That being said, airborne diseases and droplet transmission diseases like COVID-19 it's not as black and white as we wish it would be. And there is some gray zone in between, like you've been hearing lately about maybe somebody who's just talking to you, not actually coughing, could transmit the infection to you. Maybe there are situations in which the infection could travel more than 6 feet. But the majority of the transmission is that 6 foot distance maximum with those larger droplets.
Okay, so that's actually really helpful because the advice we've had over time has changed. First, you don't need to wear a mask. Maybe you do need to wear a mask. Stay 6 feet apart. Maybe 6 feet isn't enough. But it sounds like what you're saying is that when you average it out and you use reasonable safety precautions, that 6 foot distance is a good number.
That's a good way to think of it.
All right, let's grab one more call while we can. We've got Kara on the line from Martha's Vineyard. Kara, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick question on, I'm not sure, because of the unknown, what we do know about being asymptomatic and what that means for how long is someone asymptomatic. And so if I am asymptomatic and I'm unknowingly passing around the disease, how long is someone doing that?
Yeah.
Great question. Dr. Jerome.
Great question. So increasingly, we all have learned the word asymptomatic. That means that you have infection without symptoms. What we know is that there are definitely people who test positive who have no symptoms, and we know that there are people who are pre-symptomatic, which means they test positive and they're about to get symptoms. So those both of those categories exist, and also people who test positive and do have symptoms. Now, those asymptomatic people, we believe that they play some role in the transmission of infection, certainly not the largest role, because, again, they're not coughing, they're not transmitting those droplets, they're not wiping their runny noses and you know, touching the escalator because they don't have a runny nose, but they probably play some role. Now, in terms of how long somebody is infectious or contagious when they're asymptomatic or symptomatic, that's one of the big unknowns. What we know is that you can test people over and over and over, and some people will become test negative in a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and some people have a positive test for 6 weeks. And they may have no symptoms at all for that entire 6 weeks, but the test positivity does not equate to being contagious because the test only measures the presence of the RNA, the element of the virus that the test was meant to detect, was invented to detect. We don't have a test for contagiousness, and so that remains one of the big unknowns for this virus.
So with that in mind, Dr. Jerome, in our last minute or so, with that uncertainty in mind, what is your message to people out there who are struggling with the tension? They want to be safe, they want to keep others safe, but they're concerned about their employment, their mental well-being, their rights as these shutdowns continue.
All I can say is that, I feel for everyone that's out there, trying to do the right thing and struggling, and everyone is struggling. We are trying to get to a point where we have reached my professional society, the Infectious Disease Society of America, sort of refers to as the three T's: testing, tracing, and treatment. The treatment is what we talked about. We don't have a miracle cure for the disease, but at least having the resources to treat people who need to go to the hospital without an overwhelmed medical system. The testing, having that capacity to actually find out who has it, ramping up testing availability so that people who are sick can all go and get the test. And then the tracing piece is so that every time we detect someone sick, we can find their contacts and quarantine them so we can slow this thing down.
That's Dr. Shira Jerome, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Thanks for joining me and our listeners today on Radio Boston, Dr. Jerome.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Earlier this hour, we discussed protests against the coronavirus stay-at-home orders, as well as with a Tufts Medical Center epidemiologist about the importance of social distancing and keeping people safe. Joining us now on the line is Joan Donovan. She's the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center, and she focuses on online extremism, media manipulation, and disinformation campaigns. Joan Donovan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So what we want to talk about today is the role of misinformation in the time of a pandemic. So are you listeners, are you seeing misinformation about the coronavirus and COVID-19? How are you separating fact from fear in this pandemic? Where is your confusion and how do you make sure you've got good information? Call us and ask questions or share your thoughts. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Joan, let's just start. Are you concerned about the flow of quality information available to people, at least here in this country during this pandemic, or are we in pretty good shape?
Oh, dear. Yes, we are very concerned about the flow of information right now. The World Health Organization has declared that there's two crises going on. We have the pandemic, which is where the hospitals are being hit hardest on the front lines, dealing with really a medical anomaly, right? There's not even a generation of doctors you can look to that have been through a pandemic that can help younger doctors understand where we're going. But the infodemic is what the WHO describes as the overabundance of information, some accurate and some not, that makes it hard for people to find trustworthy sources and reliable guidance when they need it. And that really means, like, what happens if you search, you know, on Google, for instance, for what are the symptoms of coronavirus? Do you get reputable information when you need it or not? And you might not get reputable information if you search for how do I get tested for coronavirus. There's a lot of scams out there that are trying to sell at-home testing, which doesn't exist.
So Joan, at the beginning of the hour, one of the things that we talked about were protests against shelter in place, economic shutdown, etc. Many of the arguments that we heard were based on real economic hardship, real concerns about civil liberties, et cetera. There has also been a line of discussion about those protests suggesting that some people may be participating in them based on lack of quality information about what the risks really are, or, and I think this is an even more important point to ask you about, because people don't trust that the information coming to them, whether it's from the government or from media sources, is quality information that is not being manipulated for some particular end. What do we do when we're in that moment?
You know, in calmer times, maybe people would trust the experts in this situation, but we are already enmeshed in a highly polarized political environment. But for people to trust the science, they have to trust the scientists. So undergirding these reopen protests, we've seen people, you know, we've seen the videos, people are not social distancing, they're not wearing masks, and they're chanting Fire Fauci because they know that the president is getting his information from his medical advisors. And then governors also have a set of medical advisors that they are getting their information from. And so the basis of these protests is medical misinformation, that they do believe that somehow the experts are part of this grand scheme to crash the economy. And the kind of conspiracy theories that we're seeing around this have a lot to do with political polarization and then not trusting medical recommendations. But I hear people about their concerns about civil liberties, and there are responsible ways to protest right now. I have seen people, protest in their cars and drive their cars around a state house and put up signs on their cars. I think there are ways people can express their anger, but do so in a way that's responsible to their health.
Just before the break, we were talking with Dr. Shira Daron at Tufts about how this is an evolving situation, what we do know and what we don't know. And that can actually, over time, lead to differing guidance. Does that change in guidance or the differentiation in guidance, maybe even depending on who you're hearing it from, In your research, does that lead to confusion and to lack of compliance in the public?
Definitely. So let's take, for instance, the controversy around the change in advisory around masks. Some people believe that there was a change in advisory because the science had evolved. That's what I tend to, that's what I believe, is that we did eventually have science that was showing us that it was airborne and that we needed to take greater precautions. The earlier rationale for not having people wear masks scientifically was about the way in which wearing a mask doesn't necessarily fit your face really well. And so people will touch their face even more by wearing a mask. If that explanation is insufficient for you, and depending upon who you hear it from, you may in your mind choose to believe some other explanation. The other explanation that we've seen is that the government was trying to prevent a run on N95 masks and on PPE. However, that happened anyway, right? Despite the medical recommendation. And so I do believe that the mask recommendation could have been handled much more smoothly, but at the same time, it's really hard to actually get your expert information into the public's hands, given the abundance of misinformation and conspiracy that's already out there. It's really hard to get at your audience these days.
So what about people like J.R. Hull, the former representative that we heard from at the very beginning of our show, who for him in organizing a protest, it wasn't about trusting or not trusting the information as much as, even if the risks are as I'm being told they are, it's just too far. We're just going too far.
You know, as someone who has studied science and scientific communication in the past, I haven't seen a moment really in recent history where this kind of anomaly, this medical anomaly, you know, with this novel coronavirus has really needed precautions like this. However, we can look to other countries and realize this isn't just about the U.S. You know, many other countries that have high rates of infection are doing the exact same protocol. And so I do find it hard to believe that somehow that this is a conspiracy about America in particular, when I see other countries also participating in social distancing and, you know, the stay-at-home orders are really preventing people from going out to socialize, and the, you know, keeping open the essential businesses, of course, is very important. But the people working in those essential businesses, they too are very afraid and don't want to, you know, be caught up in this either. And so I do think that if we're going to have a plan for public health, we actually really do need everyone to cooperate and do the same thing. But I don't necessarily think it's something specific to the U.S. where somehow if we just went back to it would work itself out, because we also cannot sustain the economic devastation of, you know, several hundred thousand people dying at once.
Yeah. Joan, I want to grab a call on that, actually. We've got Sean on the line from Sharon. Sean, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to call and say, you know, I was actually fired during this epidemic, and I can't get unemployment at this time, so I don't know how I'm going to take care
Sean.
Of all the bills, but that's all right. But, I mean, money is metaphysics. Human life is the most important thing, and money exists in order to help improve human life. And if it does the opposite, then we need to do away with it. And so right now, human life is more important than money. And we're proving that as a world. And that's really important. So, you know, I detest these protesters, but the few that there are making me happy, because I understand that there's enough people who are educated and enough people who are civilized enough to realize that that's, and you know, the president is encouraging this. So the fact that protests are so small, you know, I think that's a testament to our unity.
Sean, thanks for that. I appreciate that call. And it is something I think, Joan, to point out is that the protest people who are concerned about the economy actually are a small percentage, and that actually despite the wide range of sources of information and the extent to which you can customize your information today, polls show that people are actually like 80% or so of people are in lockstep about supporting the pain that we're all going through right now.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, by and large, my hesitancy here is about the tactic they've chosen, not the fact that I do think we need to put serious pressure on the federal government for more and better services, better cash payouts to Americans, because I think that that is, if we don't, it will lead to more social unrest. And I agree with you that protesters are always a small portion of a population. And I'm, you know, very saddened to hear that the caller lost their job in the midst of all of this. And I do wish that, again, that we weren't in such a highly polarized political environment, because if the parties could come together quicker on the needs of the people, we potentially could shift that. The other thing that's interesting, so at the Shorenstein Center, the executive director, Seti Warren, who is the former mayor of Newton, also clued me into
what... he's a guest of ours sometimes.
Oh, yeah, Seti, and he's great. And one thing he did remark to me that I think is important to understand is that states are really stuck in a strange position because they can't run a deficit. And so states want to do more for their residents, and they really can't. And so we do need to try to figure out, well, is there some kind of exception or some kind of regulation or bill that could be passed quickly that would allow for states to run a deficit in this moment and potentially offer direct aid to residents?
That's Joan Donovan. She is the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center. Joan, I appreciate you coming back today. Thanks.
Thanks, Tiziana. Appreciate it.
It's been a mostly silent spring over at Fenway Park so far, with the baseball season still suspended indefinitely. The lone exception, MLB released its report on the 2018 Red Sox sign-stealing operation this week, and we'll have more on that tomorrow. But for today, we are going to focus in on a familiar Fenway figure. And whether you know his name or not, if you've been the park to see a game, you've heard him at work. Josh Cantor first took over as the Fenway Park organist 17 years ago. And in the wake of the coronavirus crisis, he has been live streaming seventh inning stretches every day from his home. And he joins us now after having live streamed one. Josh, thanks so much for being with us on Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana. I really appreciate it.
So you could hear I could barely get through that intro because I'm just kind of giggly and excited about having you today. This is going to be so much fun. Josh, when did you decide to start doing these concerts at home? This is such a fun idea. How'd it come to you?
Thanks. It was 4 weeks ago today, what was supposed to have been the opening day of the baseball season. And my old friend Jason, who I've known for almost 30 years, he texted me and he said, why don't you do a live stream and play some songs? And I said, that sounds like fun. How do you do a live stream? And he said, I don't know, Google it, maybe watch a video tutorial. I did, and my wife, Mary, helped me set up a very crude audio-video setup that we used for the first couple of days, and we really only planned to do it once and figured a few people might stop by and I'd play for a few minutes, and on the first day, we got 100 song requests in the live chat. I managed to play about 40 of them. We went for over an hour, had many visitors, and realized as soon as we finished how much we enjoyed it, my wife, Mary, and I, and committed to doing it together every day at 3 p.m. thereafter until baseball resumes or until people get sick of it. And so we're 4 weeks in, and it's been great fun. And we have been raising money for food banks along the way, asking people who enjoy the show and who have the means to make donations. And we've been hearing from people all over the world that they're enjoying the show, they're enjoying the time together, the singing and the camaraderie and the raising funds. And it's just, the whole thing has been spectacular and has really exceeded any expectations we might have had.
Do you happen to remember what the very first song you played 4 weeks ago was?
I have no idea. I just, Yeah, I mean, I don't even remember. We just did a show today from 3 to 3:30, and I don't even remember what I played 20 minutes ago. So that's just the nature of the thing, is because so many songs get thrown at me, and they become almost kind of disposable in a way. Like, as soon as I play one, I have to move on to start thinking about the next one. But the one we've been doing today consistently is Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and that has to do with this notion of why we call the show Seventh Inning Stretch, and we feel is a time when people maybe need a stretch, and it's an opportunity for people to take a break, forget the many worries and trouble that we all are facing right now. And we start off at or near, you know, the beginning of every show with by playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game and encouraging people to stand, stretch, and sing along, and to say, I do care if I ever get, rather than I don't care if I ever get back.
So, Josh, your line is a little bit choppy. I just want to acknowledge that, but it's totally worth it in order to get a chance to hear you play. Can you give us a little bit of Take Me Out to the Ball Game?
Yeah, here we go.
Is it bad that before I realized it, I was actually standing up in my little basement home studio swaying back and forth to the song? No, you can't help it.
That's what it should be. People have told us, someone told us yesterday that they've a few times, but they finally stretched time yesterday, and they remarked how good it felt. That it just felt good in their body, mind, heart, and spirit to actually do that. So I love it when people sing along, and I've been getting such amazing feedback from families, you know, kids, grandparents, and everybody in between about how this has become part of their ritual, whether it's while they're working or while they're doing chores or while they're homeschooling or while they're outside or just whatever. It's whatever enjoyment anyone gets out of it is great by me.
So, Josh, we took a bunch of listener requests in preparation for having you on the show. Do you mind, you know, maybe playing a few more as I ask you about them?
Let's give it a shot.
All right, so Chris Santos wanted to know if you could play Happy by Pharrell Williams.
I can play that one. That's a favorite of many. And I enjoy playing that one at the ballpark a lot, and it goes like this.
Awesome. What makes a good organ song for the stadium? Can anything sound great, or is there something in particular?
Most anything can. People ask me this sometimes, and I usually tell them, whatever's got a good melody, if you can hum along, if you can sing along, if it's, you know, if it sort of catches in your head, that's the main thing. And that's what will translate well. So, you know, I'm playing a lot of high end stuff and low end stuff and stuff in the middle. But it's really that the melody is the thing that's going to cut through and is going to make people want to hum along or sing along. And especially on a song like that, you know, he's like, happy, do, 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 do. It passes the do, do, do test.
That's right. All right. So here's one from producer Jamie Bologna that I know passes the doot, doot, doot test. He's requesting the Cheers theme song.
Oh, yeah. Classic, right? Let's see if I remember it. Hold on 1 second. Yeah. I
I don't really have a mute button from my broadcasting from home, and it was killing me that I couldn't mute and sing along with that. So I see your point about kind of passing the do-to-do test.
I mean, I won't complain if you decide to sing along. I don't know what the listeners
Somebody will, believe me. So what happens when someone requests something of you that you don't know how to play? Can you just wing it?
When I'm doing a live stream, I can't really wing it. If I've truly never heard of it before, and from the time I see the request until I start playing it seconds later, if it's something I'm totally 100% unfamiliar with, it's not going to work. And so those I let them pass. Fortunately, it's a good problem to have, I guess. We get way more requests than I have time for. If it's something I know a little bit, I can usually at least whip up a passable version. If I'm at the ball game, I'll get the request via Twitter from a fan in the stands, and I might have a couple of minutes time to learn it before I have to play it live, in which case I can pull up a stream of it on my laptop, listen once or twice in my earbuds, and be able to play something back that more or less kind of sounds like the song that they want to hear. And that just comes from decades of practice of doing that.
You can just do that. You can hear it once or twice and then boom, go.
Usually it's kind of like a parrot, you know, that you can say something to a parrot and it can say it back to you. It doesn't mean the parrot knows what it's saying, but it can do a sort of.
All right, let's get to another request. Our producer, Chris Siderick, wants to know if you can play Star Wars' Vader's March.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, this is another one that a lot of people like.
Seems suited to organs, to an organ.
Yeah, this one works well. Here we go.
Awesome. That's great. All right. So we've given you a lot of the stuff that our people who wrote in requests wanted. I guess I want to ask you, when you are just playing by yourself, first, do you ever do that? Do you ever just sit down and play for yourself? And if so, what do you play?
I play every single day. And that's sometimes it's for practice, for work. Sometimes it's, you know, for study. Sometimes it's just purely for fun. I mean, I play a lot of, well, when we're not in a pandemic, aside from baseball games, I play a lot of shows at local clubs and theaters around town. And sometimes I even get to travel and play shows out of town. So oftentimes I'm preparing for maybe whatever the next show or series of shows is going to be. And then other times I'm just playing for fun. And when it's for fun, it really runs the gamut. You know, I listen to all kinds of music and I like all kinds of music. So whatever strikes my fancy, it might be something real new. It might be something old. It might be something close to home. It might be something sort of far and distant and strange, but I just love playing, and I would be playing every day at 3 even if I didn't have a live stream. So the only difference is just, you know, we invite people into the living room and we press go on the Facebook button.
So we've only got a little bit more than a minute left. What I'd love to do is say goodbye to you now, which I'll do formally in a second, and then annoy my whole team, who did not want anyone to request Sweet Caroline because it gets played so much, but I thought maybe you could play it out for us as we finish up. Are you willing to do that?
I can play Sweet Caroline for you. People
all right,
love
first,
it.
Let me thank you properly. This is Fenway Park's organist, Josh Cantor, who's doing a live stream at 3 o'clock every day taking requests. Josh, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston. Oh, you can keep playing, Josh. Yep. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Glenn Alexander and music by Josh Cantor. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.